Hi everyone, my name is Zach Redrup, you're listening to the It's Not A Phase podcast, and on this episode I'm joined by Wrist Meet Razor frontman Justin Fornoff. We talk about their new album, Degeneration, creating it almost from scratch in a secluded log cabin, focusing solely on vocals after some lineup changes, lyrical inspirations, the band's love for energy drinks, and loads more. Now, if you enjoyed this or any other episode of the podcast and you want to show your support, there's a few ways that you can do that. Number one, leave a rating and review wherever you're listening to this. It takes just a few seconds and it really does help. Number two, share this on your social media, whether that be Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, wherever. Or number three, if you want to go the extra mile, you can pay a little bit each month to join the Patreon, and in return you'll get access to episodes early along with some of our perks, or you can pick up some merch from the store. All the links to that and the podcast socials where you can follow us can be found at itsnotaphase.co.uk. That's itsnotaphase.co.uk. And now with all that out of the way, let's jump right into this week's episode of It's Not A Phase. What's up everybody? Thank you for joining me on this episode of It's Not A Phase, where I'm joined by Justin of Wrist Meet Razor. How's it going, dude?
I'm great. How are you?
All good. All good, dude. So yeah, the big news is obviously third album, Degeneration, out with Prosthetic Records. How are you feeling about having this album out in the world?
It's nice to finally have it come out. We recorded this last January, so January of 2023.
Wow.
Okay. We went in to record it, and we've kind of been sitting on it and creating stuff for it for a long time now. So it's cool that all these ideas and all these things that these assets that we've compiled are all able to come out now and people can see kind of the fruits of our labor.
Yeah, especially if you, I guess the process of you creating this thing started in January of last year. So we're talking, what, 14 months for 15 months?
Right, right.
And from what I understand, you know, you went through a fairly interesting recording process where you kind of bunkered down in a log cabin in New Jersey.
Right, we did.
And I think from what I've read, it's you were there for like a whole month, more or less, and you're doing sometimes 12-hour long sessions of writing and recording. Is that right?
Yeah. So we definitely took a little bit more of an old school approach. I don't think bands really record records like this anymore, at least the bands I know. A lot of them will take different breaks and stuff like that. But I personally was very influenced by the 90s way of kind of going into seclusion almost and then being away from society far and long enough to where you could create something all that's cohesive and on the same page as one another, which was an interesting thing too, because the record wasn't really written before we showed up. See, a lot of bands, when they record records, will have like the pre-pro or whatever that they'll show up with, and then they'll try to like fine tune that with the producer and that whole thing. But we didn't really do it like that. We had ideas and we had riffs and we had all kinds of things that were going to be the record when it was done. But when we showed up, essentially, I mean, it wasn't a record. So one of the things that made it so important to be there for a month working was that we created the whole thing there. So we pre-prod for the first like 2 weeks and then we tracked for the next 2 weeks. And then for months after that, even after we left, a lot of the production ended up going in as far as like different kind of noises that we put in into the record, like different kind of production ideas. So just stuff that didn't involve us having to be there to track, but still involved lots, hours and hours of work and conceptualizing back and forth and all that.
Well, I guess that initial month is, you know, you're kind of secluded away. There's less distractions for you. So basically the only focus, the only thing you're looking at and thinking about is this record. But I guess what could also kind of be a detriment to that, and well, you can clarify this, but I imagine there were times when, you know, things got a bit stir crazy. There was a bit of like cabin fever. I don't know how often, if at all, you left the cabin other than, you know, to grab food and stuff like that you'd need.
Yeah. So we're all vegan. So we cooked every single night there. So we left three times, I think, to get groceries, and that was it. And I personally only left two of those times. Like that's period, like leaving at all. And then our guitarist, Nate, left zero of those times. He didn't even leave the times we went get food. So yeah, there was a little bit of stir craziness, I think, you know. That's all part of the whole process with recording a record, especially recording a really emotionally heavy record or a record that means something. You know, there's like a certain level of suffering that gets put into a good product, I think, when it comes to heavy music. And this, you know, played into that.
Do you feel like any of that kind of, I don't know, hyper-focus and, I mean, maybe claustrophobia isn't the right word, but that kind of feeling, did that seep into the record that, you know, fans will hear through the music, do you think? Or is it
there was definitely some claustrophobia. Yeah. I think claustrophobia is a pretty good word for that. Yeah, no, it seeps in for sure. You know, for me personally, as the lyric writer and the vocalist, I think maybe it seeps in a little bit more, but there was a certain amount of pressure put on everyone that played an instrument on this record as well, like the rest of my band. And while you might not be able to hear that, that was certainly there while it was happening. Like there was an intensity to it, as well as it being a time crunch, because, you know, I like the idea of being in seclusion, which was, again, an old school way of recording a record. However, some of the best records that I liked that were recorded that way didn't have time frames. Like, they were able to sit there and just, you know, whatever. They keep making songs until they created the record that they wanted. Sometimes that would include like 50 songs that they could whittle down. This one only had 14 tracks. There was only 14 tracks that we were able to even, you know, create in this time frame. And one of them got kicked out before we even started tracking. The 13th one is the bonus track on the record, the hidden track.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, going in as well with kind of, as you said before, somewhat of a clean slate, you had a few like riffs and ideas as, I guess, reference points. But other than that, you know, going in, like say, with a clean slate, did that as well bring any pressure on top of the time crunch to basically get a record together within those 30 days, like hoping there was no writer's block or anything like that that's going to come in?
Yeah, no, it definitely did. But with that said, everyone in this band is a very, very competent musician. And I had the utmost faith that it would get done one way or another. Because usually if one of us kind of falls off and has a little bit of a writer's block, another one of us has, you know, other ideas. It's a thing where we're all very fortunate that we're surrounded by so many thoughtful and creative people. So that played into it a lot too. That helped, especially on some of the days where things weren't happening as quickly as we would have liked. If one of us was down, another person stepped up. So it ended up working out well in that regard. However, if it was another band, maybe even bands that are like very, very driven by one person, like when that happens, it does derail the whole thing. And we were kind of fortunate that that wasn't the case for us.
Yeah, I guess like if someone, like you say, had a bit of a writer's block or just weren't feeling anything creatively, then I guess there was always someone there who can kind of lift them up and pick them up for a little bit during that kind of lull period for them.
Right, or just kind of take up the slack, honestly, because we all kind of had the idea of what the record was going to sound like. So it wasn't a thing where one of us was kind of carrying the entire concept and the entire like musical credibility of the record. That idea was in flux and kind of was created through the hardship. It was more solidified through the hardship. And I think that's something that makes this record special, especially compared to other records from our peers that were written by one person. Like this one, there was a very strong group effort towards solidifying what the record was going to sound like and what it is.
And that's a rarity sometimes, isn't it? Like sometimes, yeah. You kind of mentioned it before, you know, some bands have like maybe one or two principal songwriters, whereas if you were all kind of pitching in, you all know the vision, you're all very clear on going in the same direction to create the record that you've made, then yeah, that's just obviously super beneficial for you guys.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we do, obviously, you know, like other bands, there is usually going to be one or two guys that do a majority of the actual writing. Our guitar player, Tyler, does a lot of the actual riff writing as far as that goes. But when it comes to like structuring music and kind of creatively putting out ideas that will spark new seeds of the future, I think we all kind of had a very exact idea of what that was going to be.
Well, you worked as well with Randy LaBeouf for, you know, on the producer kind of side of things, and people listening who might not be familiar with his work, you know, he's worked with The Acacia Strain, Dying Wish, and Kublai Khan, just for a few examples. What was it like working with him on this record?
It was great. You know, Randy is a guy that has an unlimited number of different talents. Like, he's very, very good, and he listens to a wide variety of music, so he understands music in a way that very few other producers that we've ever worked with or that I've even known can do. So we were very, very fortunate to have Randy there. And Randy also helped a lot too. Randy co-wrote quite a few of the riffs on this record as well. Like he had a heavy hand in it, and he was another tool that we had in the studio, especially when things kind of like when we would need a pick me up. Like he had ideas and he was willing to introduce those into our ideas as well. So he's just as much part of this record as all of the band members as well. He's great. And all his other records are great too. He does a little bit of everything as well, because he mixes, and then he engineers, and then he'll master it. Like he does everything. So in that way, it's very special, because not a lot of producers, but there are a handful of producers that they don't necessarily involve themselves in the engineer side of it, where they don't mix and master it. That is all a separate thing. But this is all a concise vision created by a circle of people all in the same living situation, which makes it unique and cool in a way that very few other bands can. I think if you have the opportunity to do that and you're in a band, there's no reason not to. It's like, it's a special thing for sure. And especially in 2024, in a year where things can be piecemealed out so easily to a number of different people. And then when that happens, even though, you know, and there are a lot of bands and people that swear by that, and, you know, who am I to say that that's not the right way to do it? But I feel like when you hand off your work to three other people to mix, master, and do all this other stuff to it, like in some ways, not everyone is going to be on the same page. They can't possibly be, you know? But when you have your team that makes everything, and then it gets mixed and mastered by a guy that co-wrote and produced the record, like that's massive, you know? That's unreplaceable.
Yeah, like, so he's like seen the whole vision. He knows what you're going for from start to finish, because, you know, there's so many producers out there that will, well, not so many, but I'm sure there's producers out there that will just, they don't really want to create the best record possible. They're more, they're like, hey, just press record and just put all the tracks together. And that's essentially it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and like the job of a producer is very, very important when it comes to making music. And I think that can never be overlooked, especially from, you know, bands in our genre. Having another voice out there that's not a voice inside the band tell you what they think sounds good is actually a very, very important aspect of creating something that's good, in my opinion. But with that said, yeah, like they can absolutely make or break the record as far as how much they care and how much of themselves they put into it. And you, like, Randy is really good about putting himself in every record that he does. And that's, you know, important.
Yeah, definitely. I believe you had Kevin from Old Wounds. He guested on the album on one of the tracks. How did he get involved in the project?
So I've known Kevin for many, many years now, since the beginning of Old Wounds, actually, since the early days of the band. And I've wanted to do lots of stuff with him. Wrist Me Razors almost toured with Old Wounds a couple times in the end. In the end of their band, we almost did a couple of their tours, and it never worked out, but it was one of those things where I always kind of had it in the back of my mind where if we were in a situation where it made sense to have him do guest vocals, it would be a priority of mine that he did. And this one just lined up because he lives in New Jersey. He was like an hour away. Yeah, he was perfect for the spot. Another very, very cool thing that I'm excited to get feedback on from the record, because I think it's something that people should really like.
So did he come up to the cabin as well, or was that something that you did kind of after that initial 30 days?
No, he actually came up. That was, again, that's another like important kind of special thing that I like, is like the in-person synergy of having multiple people in the room and kind of feeling it. And Kevin came up, took a whole day, drove up, spent a whole night with us, and fucking recorded the guest spot. And it was very, very cool. It was one of those moments where like we were all in the same room listening to him do these vocal tracks, and they were great. They were amazing. And I think that kind of special feeling can't be replicated by someone just recording it somewhere else and then sending it to him. So, and the fact that this record was all done so personally, it has such a personal feel to it, that aspect of it was also important. And so it's there forever. And I'm very proud of the fact that he was able to do it and what he ended up doing. It's awesome.
Absolutely, man. So this album also sees, you know, a few lineup changes since the Less record. You know, you've got Elaine's in the fold picking up the bass. You're doing vocals solely now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Nate's on the guitar as well. What do you think this lineup change and, you know, those new members as well brought to the table on this record that maybe we didn't see on the previous Wrist Meat Razor albums?
So it's interesting in that for the last record, when we were recording it, I really started to think that I didn't want to be the bass player anymore as well as the singer. But the plan was I was going to still play bass and sing for the Replica of a Strange Love record cycle, touring cycle. What ended up actually happening was that COVID hit and we pre-prod Replica in March, or actually in February, right before everything shut down. And then we recorded it in June after everything had shut down. But there wasn't really a set time period for how long everything was going to be. So as that dragged on and on and on, it got to the point where I really was ready to move on from playing bass. And so I had asked Elaine to play bass, and she was into that. And so the first tour that we did back from COVID, Elaine was the bass player, and then I was the vocalist. And then the second tour, we got Nate, who plays in a band called Heavens Die, to be the guitar player and fill in Phil Jonas' spot, who was our original guitar player. And we toured with that unit for, you know, like a year and a half or 2 years almost.
Right.
So going into the studio, it helped a lot because we had two new creative voices in the room with us while we were writing the songs, which added a lot to what we, you know, had going into the last record and going into this record. Like there was definitely more, and that was awesome. But I think the best part was that we had already gelled on the road. So it wasn't like an uncomfortable thing where it's like they're walking into a situation where they're not entirely comfortable with having a voice. Like they had already been around us, so they were comfortable saying what they felt, which is very important, especially in something like that.
Yeah, definitely, because I think as well, like when there's new members on board and they get involved in the first album since they've joined, I guess sometimes they feel like, oh, is this, am I right to say this, is this fully my band just yet? And there's a bit of apprehension as to how much they can contribute when that, you know, I guess in their minds, they've only contributed a small part so far in that band's career.
Yeah. And this record, importantly, is different from the other records in a lot of very key ways. So having new kind of blood on it is part of why it's so special, I think. Like that's what makes it a cool record. It makes it a different record from our other ones.
Yeah. Well, the first album, you were a trio. The second album, there was four of you. This album, there's five of you. There's going to be six on the next album.
Yeah, maybe, man. Maybe. I wouldn't put it past.
Yeah. Soon enough, you'll be like Slipknot. So
there you go. Yeah. We need a DJ and a keyboardist and a sampler and all that shit.
And a keg as well.
And a keg for sure.
Yeah. Do you feel like being in a position where you're solely the vocalist that allowed you to expand more, you know, not just vocally and as a frontman, but, you know, not having to think about when you're writing the vocal arrangements, like, is this going to be too difficult live to play bass and sing these correctly and like the correct arrangement and in the, you know, the correct cadence and stuff like that?
Right. I think bands are better with a lead singer, honestly. I think there's a certain charm in doing the three-piece thing. Like there was a certain charm in even doing the four-piece thing with me doing the vocals. But ultimately, when you go see a live band, you're not going to be able to sing along to the lyrics if the guy has a stationary mic. It just doesn't work, you know? And you're not really going to be able to get the same kind of thing with a standalone vocalist doing his own thing while the other band members who are playing instruments do their own thing. Like, it just doesn't work in the same dynamic. And I think for certain projects, it's really cool. And I think it has worked in cool ways, but for us, and especially where the band was going, it was going to be much better for me to kind of explore what I wanted to do on stage, which was definitely going to add something to our live show, which I think it did, because not even that it matters, but there, to certain extents, were people in the beginning of Wrist Meat Razor who would make public posts about how they thought the band was boring live or things like that. Just that we didn't move around enough or we didn't do enough, you know, which was understandable because we were three people all playing instruments and doing vocals at the same time. Like, it wasn't easy to also go crazy. So we would try to move around as much as we could, but there was a lot of focus that had to go into putting out doing the songs live. It took a lot of focus. And now it's different from that. We were able to really go crazy, which is funny too, because I feel like there's a little bit of like, of hindsight, maybe from other people, not necessarily from us, but from other people as to what the band was like as a three-piece, as opposed to what it was like now. But the reality is, as a three-piece, it was hard for us to fully like put on a good live show because we were so focused on playing and singing at the same time.
Yeah. So how did you kind of adapt then when you started introducing these live shows where you were only focusing on the vocals? Did it take you kind of time to kind of warm up to that new role and not having this, you know, bass guitar in your hand at the same time?
In the very, very beginning, it was a little strange, but that wore off really quick. Cause I've always kind of thought of myself as a singer. So I would always picture what I would do, usually even when I was playing bass and singing. So it was easy to do the swap into being just the vocalist for sure. Right. For me at least.
Right. Well, lyrically on this album as well, you kind of gravitate towards themes of misanthropy and hypocrisy morally within like society and I guess religion in some aspects as well.
Right.
Was there anything specifically that was inspiring you or directing you when you were writing those lyrics in that cabin over those 30 days?
The lyrics especially that touch on things like hypocrisy were more or less built up over a long period of time. I would say that the lyrics are written from kind of an absurdist, misanthropic point of view, but not necessarily from one that's nihilistic. I felt that it was really important to get across a point of what I saw in the world, which was more or less that instead of it being Big Brother that I find to be the most offensive, it's more so Little Brother, and it's people that idolize kind of the corruption at the highest levels of society and then replicate it and then force it upon anyone that's smaller. Essentially, it's the world kind of creating these mini kind of bubbles of like consumerist oppression where the top still believes they're the 1%, even if they aren't the actual 1%. Every different little subculture of society has these different 1%, and they all exist within the same exact hypocrisies where they're fighting the bigger power in their own minds, but instead they really are just a microcosm of the same problem. And a lot of the record is about that and how I see that as a great degeneration on society. And I wrote the record from the perspective of how that degeneration is reflected upon me and then how I reflect it back and a lot of the struggles that I feel through that on a regular basis.
Right. Well, I know obviously throughout the catalog of the band, you kind of do touch on parts here and there of like religion, like, you know, talking right. about religion and like, especially those first two EPs, obviously the titles reference religion. And then you've got the artwork for Degeneration, which is, you know, you've got these mechanical people on crucifixes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if, you know, growing up, you had much of a religious background yourself, but how much do you feel religion and that kind of doctrination kind of plays a part and influences you in the music you create and the lyrics you write?
So I was raised Catholic and I was confirmed and baptized as Catholic.
Right.
And I did a lot of Catholicism in schooling and all of that. So I'm pretty well versed on that subject. But when it comes to Wrist Meat Razor, a lot of the religion is metaphorical, especially mm-hmm. on this record. But as well as in the past, like the first two EPs are Sylvia Plath references. That's a Sylvia Plath quote cut into two pieces. Right. But it follows the same general thing, especially Bible study with an atheist, which I didn't write, to be fair. Jonah wrote the lyrics to those. But like theoretically, we follow a lot of the same kind of ideas. And then moving forward with that, I can't remember if Misery Never Forgets really touches on anything religious, really, as far as the metaphors go. But on Replica of a Strange Love, the track Nietzsche is Dead is a play on Nietzsche's phrase, God is dead. And it was It was a vague kind of religious reference to the idea that Christianity kind of built Nietzsche up as kind of this demon that needed to be killed after he said that God was dead. And then once he was killed, they kind of gloated upon his death as it was like some sort of like monolithic kind of achievement. And it's strange to me that like that moment ended up being so important later, where Nietzsche was killed again by people that theoretically should have agreed with him in what he was saying, because they were angry about other things that he believed. I just found there was so many different hypocrisies amongst kind of both sides of the fence when it came to his kind of existence. And on this record, I touched on, again, religion is very metaphorical on this record, but there is a song called Dog Day God on the record that is about a pastor who went on the dark web and bought a hitman to kill his wife. And the screen name he used was Dog Day God. The song is more or less pointing out that I find very similar hypocrisies in the Christian right as I do in some of the far left in how they view morality. The song is very heavily about just the general idea of fascistic morality. And I see so many similarities in it that I felt it was important to bring it up. Though, again, like the name would lead you to believe that it's all religious, but it's just using religion as a metaphor for something more than that. Because I think religion, especially in America at least, is something that exists so strongly metaphorically in our lives that it's undeniable. But there are a lot of non-religious entities in this country, and in America at least, that I think are just as bad as kind of a fascistic Christian morality that I feel, as someone that was raised Catholic and kind of shamed for being himself, is still relevant just in other ways.
Yeah, and I guess you're just using something that people can easily reference and attribute it to, such as like religious metaphors and iconography and stuff like that.
Right.
So it's easy for them to kind of digest and get the point that you're trying to make in the lyrics.
Exactly. And it, to, you know, to go back to the album art too, it's, again, it's not like, it's not literal, but there is, you know, the idea, the image of a, you know, a mechanical messianic kind of figure being crucified is more or less kind of what I feel like anyone that kind of serves underneath, again, this little brother 1% in whatever pocket of society, that's what the rest of us would be. Like, you are crucified by the ones that feel like they can't oppress anyone because they've been given enough power to do that. And there's so many different sects of society which are controlled by a very small portion of the public. And that's on a larger scale and that's on a smaller scale. And ultimately, I felt that that was an interesting topic to use when creating kind of this larger dialogue of degeneration.
Well, yeah, that artwork that was created by Alex, is it Alex Ekman-Lorne? Is that the guy?
Yes, made it? That's him, yeah.
Do you feel like, obviously, those crucifixes that you mentioned, like industrialized and mechanical, how do you feel that visually represents the album as a whole?
So I was very I was very kind of influenced by Dave McKean, who is a guy who did art in the 90s. He did a bunch of the Sandman novels, and he did like the album art for like Fear Factory. And then in the 2000s, he did it for like Suicide Silence. He did the Cleansing album art. And I really, really liked his art because I felt like it was so gritty and real and kind of scary almost. And I thought that if someone was going to be able to recreate this image that I had in my head, it was going to be him. And it ultimately ended up really, really true, because he, even the other versions of this album art that no one got to see, they look awesome. Like, it looks so cool. He was able to create so many different, like, very vivid kind of come to life moments with the things that, you know, we've been talking about in this interview. It basically was what I discussed with him before we created this. But yeah, he's an amazing artist. And he needs definitely far more attention than he gets, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the artwork's great. And I guess those other ones you mentioned that, you know, didn't make the cut for the final piece of, you know, the album artwork that everyone sees. Uh-huh. I guess you could always use them potentially as like, you know, alternative ones for maybe those are deluxe edition or like a issue or something like that.
Well, he, you know, it's cool. And this is also really cool about Alex. And a thing that I really like about what he does is he's actually posted quite a few of the things that didn't make the cut for us just on his story and stuff, but he doesn't post what it is. So if you follow him, you've probably seen him, but you didn't know that you were seeing him. And I think that's awesome. Like, I don't know. He's, again, it's like a thing where the mystique of Wrist Meat Razor is something that I find important. So ultimately having people in our circle that buy into that mystique is also very fucking cool. And he is a person that buys into that mystique. So
yeah, you've got to put all those Easter eggs down and get a bit of lore going for the fans.
Yeah, there's tons. And who knows, you probably will post some more. So if you're listening to this, go follow Alex Ekman Lawn on Instagram. Like all his posts. You'll probably see some cool stuff.
Keep an eye out for it, yeah. Didn't Elaine dabble in some of the imagery across the album as well, like with the singles and, you know, your website as well?
Yeah, so Elaine did all of the website stuff, and she did a lot of the directing on the music video and a lot of the aesthetic creation on the music video, and then some of the t-shirt designs that you'll see on tour, she did those, and then some of the aesthetic kind of creations on our Instagram and that kind of go with the website, but a lot of those are if it's attributed to her, she did those too. So she did a lot of what the aesthetic is for this record, a lot of aesthetic building kind of things.
Yeah. But yeah, it definitely like represents on the website, which kind of has like a retro feel, like the site map and stuff on there.
Right.
I noticed as well, you can click on, you know, each of, you know, the members, yourself and the others. And there's like a little, you put like little bios about yourself. And what I liked was the fuel bit. And it seems like you're all fans of like caffeine and energy drinks.
Yeah. She was influenced by a lot of the kind of the golden age of band websites, where bands put a lot of effort into the creation of a larger world around them. And the part of the larger world is like, you create a website, you know, you do more than just the bare minimum. And so she was really into that and wanted to like expand a lot on it, and did, and created like a very, very cool website that we have that I feel like a lot of people don't. So.
Yeah. Cause I guess like a lot of what bands do now is focus on their social media pages, which obviously is important. And sometimes they don't even have a site. It's just direct to the social media. Whereas with a website, I guess you can just do so much more. Like it's entirely your domain. You can do whatever you want with it.
Exactly. And you know, it's one of those things too. There's a lot of bands with a lot of money being put behind them that still only have like a link tree or something. Like they have the domain, but you just go to it and it's just a link tree. I think it's very important that when you put out music or you put out art, that you try to actually maximize what you can do with that, like do as much as you possibly can. Like, I think it's a total missed opportunity when you don't do stuff like that. And Elaine was very adamant that we had actual cool stuff to push. And she also did the single art too. Like, it was just all kind of part of the aesthetic building of the record and the world. Like, and like you said earlier, like lore. Like people, if you don't like lore, you should, because it's a cool aspect of, you know, the larger scope of a band is kind of the intricate pieces put together that created that. And I'm a big fan of Easter eggs and kind of hidden meanings and stuff like that. And so that's always been a part of this band. It was a part of this band on the last two records, and it's seriously a part of the band for now, for this record and now. And the website adds a lot to that, because it's a very intricate thing that was scrutinized, all of it.
Yeah. And like I say, you've got those little bios, so people can actually learn more about you individually as members as well. Like, it makes them feel more connected to you as a band.
The bio thing I think is so cool, because that's like an old website thing. Like, they all used to have that. There used to be definitely a personalization of like, these are the members, these are the things that they like, this is who they are, that kind of in a lot of ways has been like washed away in favor of fucking a Twitter feed or an Instagram feed. Like, who gives a fuck, honestly? Like, I don't care what you think about everything going on. Like, give me like give me a short blurb of like the cool stuff so I can feel like I can relate to you. Cause when I go to your Twitter feed, I don't feel like I can relate to you. And I would assume a lot of people are the same way. Like your Twitter feed isn't relatable. It's just your fucking, it's just a bunch of fucking shit you said. It's not like who you are, the things you like, or, you know, some larger kind of a more important thing.
Yeah. Make sure you come across more human. Whereas a lot of bands, I guess it comes across as they're on a bit of a pedestal, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And their Twitter feeds are the same way. Like their Twitter feeds make them look like they're on a pedestal. They look beyond reproach, even though they're not, you know, even though they're just some fucking guy. I think that's the cool thing about the website thing. It's just like, yeah, like there's a level of mystique to it. There's a level of mystery, but also it's real people. It's a real thing, you know? It's not some sort of like beyond reproach rock star fucking thing, even if it's pretending to be a very DIY thing, and it's not. Like it's not that either. It's all very, very understandable and hopefully something relatable and something people get into.
Yeah. Yeah. And fans know that if they want to get you a drink, they just come and bring you a Red Bull.
Straight up. Honestly. Like that's huge too. Especially on the road. Like if you read the websites and you see that one of those fuel types is something you want to bring to a show, bring it to a show.
Yeah.
I guarantee 100 times out of 100, we will be super, super appreciative and give you whatever you want for that. So
if you get like 10 Red Bulls at one show, just don't chug them all at once, because I don't think you'll make it to the end of the show.
Dude, I'm bad with the Red Bulls. I will chug at least a couple of them probably right away.
Yeah. I'm more partial to Monster, but this year I've made myself like not have the full sugar ones. I'm just having sugar-free ones to try and be a little bit healthier with it.
Elaine also likes the Monster ones. So Elaine and I live together, so she will get those, and I do drink them sometimes. Mm. Monsters are they're rough for me though, man. Like that's a lot of caffeine.
Yeah.
I also try to back off when I'm not on the road. So I love Red Bulls. And when I'm on the road, it's definitely it's usually an everyday thing, and maybe sometimes an every other day thing, but it's usually an everyday thing. So that's why I would chug them if you gave them to me, because I'm not drinking them right now. Like right now, I will drink a coffee in the morning, and then at some point in time in the afternoon, I'll drink a Red Bull, and that's it. That's the entirety of my caffeine intake
for a
day. But when I'm on the road, especially when we're about to play, or if I have to do a drive or whatever, you know, whatever the case is, I need to be awake. The Red Bull is the go-to immediately. Yeah. As soon as the gas station stops made, the Red Bull is getting bought. So,
yeah. What do you think? Have you had any of the flavored Red Bulls?
Oh, yeah. I love them all. I'm a big fan. People that like know me know this, but I'm a big fan of the seasonal Red Bulls, like really big fan of them. I typically like all of them. I like the summer ones more than the winter ones usually, but the last couple of winter ones I've liked. The pear cinnamon that they did this year, I really liked that one. And then the Juneberry, which was the summer one for last year, everyone liked that one, but I also like that one a lot too. And then the one coming up, the new summer one, which is going to be like an elderflower one, is going to be crazy. And I can't wait for that. And hopefully that's available right now while we're on tour. But if not, then hopefully that's available on the next tour, because I want to get into that one.
You get way more interesting flavors than we do here in the UK. I think we get coconut, we get blueberry, orange, and I want to say cherry, and then that's it.
Yeah, what they do, like the coconut one's interesting, and I'm going real far off topic here. I'm just going into Red Bull lore. But yeah, the coconut one's interesting because that was the summer flavor like 3 years ago or 4 years ago or something. And then once they become a successful summer flavor, then they turn it into an individual one, and then it's year round. But my need for a new flavor always, like after it's been pushed past its seasonal limit, I'm usually not that interested anymore. Right. So for example, last year's Juneberry is now available. I can't remember what it's called, something blue, but sea blue. That one's available now everywhere, but I don't want to drink that one. I already drank it. Mm-hmm. I did last summer. I need to do this summer. I got to keep moving forward with my Red Bull flavors.
Yeah. Always got to go to the next one.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the worst energy drink you've ever had?
That's a good question. The worst energy drink I've ever had? You know, and this is an offensive answer for a lot of people.
Right.
But I would say Rain is probably the worst one I've had. I can't do the super, super concentrated high energy.
Are they the ones with like a knight's helmet on the front? Is that?
Yeah, yeah. And I know so many people that swear by Rain, and it's like their favorite ever. Even people in this band.
Right.
Brian and Tyler drink Rain's fairly regularly. I've seen Brian shotgun a Rain, which is painful to think about. But I've seen him literally shotgun a Rain energy drink in a gas station parking lot. So I know that he enjoys Rain a lot. But for me, the only times I've really tried to dig into Rain, it has caused me to be like a jittery mess. Like I can't sit still. Like I feel like my skin's going to like tear off or something. It feels horrible, honestly.
Right.
That's what's funny. And so even though I really do like energy drinks so much, I don't like over-caffeinating myself too much.
Yeah.
I think there's like such a sweet spot that you can get. And Red Bulls are basically just slightly more caffeinated soda for the most part. Like it's the more you drink, the more caffeine it is, obviously. But like for like the 12-ounce ones or the smaller than that, even the 8-ounce or whatever it is, 10-ounce, like those don't do anything to anyone because it's not a lot of caffeine. And I like that though. Like I like hitting that sweet spot so it's not too much. So yeah, I would say Rain, also because Rain just kind of tastes like, it tastes very chemically. It just tastes kind of like poison, which is it's the point. You know what I mean? Like you drink something like that because you really want to be awake and it makes you very awake. That's for sure. But
yeah,
it's not as enjoyable for sure.
Yeah. I think it was a Mike Tyson one and it just tasted like battery acid and it just made me feel so uneasy all day.
Yeah. Like the highest level of caffeine concentration is intense. See, the other thing is I don't do drugs and I don't drink alcohol. I've been straight edge for 20 something years.
Right.
So I'm not necessarily interested in that kind of extreme kind of body high that you get through a bunch of caffeine or whatever. You know what I mean? I don't like it. Like it doesn't, I don't seek it out or anything, but I do like, you know, I do like things that taste good. I do like a little bit of caffeine. It's nice, but you know,
yeah,
to an obsessive extent, no.
Yeah. Well, if you guys ever come to the UK, I'll get you some UK special brands and see what
I would love that. And hopefully we'll be in the UK next year. That's the hope right now.
Cool. Well, back to the band. You know, you mentioned, you know, going on the road, and of course the album's out. What else is planned for 2024 so far? What kind of tours and shows are we looking at here?
Nothing I can really divulge, but just more touring in the US at least this year. Would really like to get to Canada this year too, so that's on the docket. And then hopefully next year is when we'll start exploring the UK and Europe more. So those are the kind of the plans we have. I'd love to play any kind of fests and stuff like that. A lot of that's out of our hands, but typically it ends up coming together in one way or another. I mostly am concerned, or not concerned, but I mostly put my focus into doing the best that we can do as a live show, like putting together the best product that represents the band and that people are going to want to see. After that, like beyond that, we have a booking agent and I kind of leave it up to him to be more concerned about what we're actually getting. I'm down to play whatever. We'll play whatever. I just want to put on a good show. That's all I'm concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the main thing, right? You don't want to, if you put out a good record, but your live show sucks, then what's the point?
Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to touring, to a certain extent, a lot of that's out of the band's hands anyways. Like it's in the, like I can book our own tours. Like I can be involved in that aspect. But when it comes to us touring with other bands, that's not on me. And so to be concerned about that or to have some sort of like what a fixation on it, like does none of us any good. So I try not to even consider that.
Yeah.
You know, when we're planning out the year, it'll happen or it won't.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a healthy way of thinking about it as well.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time, Justin. I really appreciate you kind of divulging into, you know, the new album and obviously energy drinks as well towards the end there.
Of course.
Before I let you go and enjoy the rest of your day, any final words, anything to say or plug? Floor is yours.
Nothing to exactly plug. The record's out now, Degeneration. hopefully if you're listening to this, you are listening to that record and you're enjoying that. And then hopefully if you see us in a town near you, you'll come out, you'll bring an energy drink, or you won't and just come say hi, one or the other.
Take care of yourself. Hopefully see you in the UK at some point next year then. And yeah, thanks again.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
See you later, dude. And that is it. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you enjoyed this or any other episode of the podcast, then please leave a rating and review wherever you're listening to this. If you want to support the podcast further, you can go and give it a follow on social media, pick up something from the merch store, or subscribe to the Patreon to get early access to episodes. All the links can be found at itsnotaphase.co.uk. That's itsnotaphase.co.uk. Thanks again, hopefully catch you on the next one, and remember, it's not a phase, it's a lifestyle.